All right, well, let's begin. We are in for a real treat in this afternoon's panel. My name is Judge Brian Hagedorn. I'm a judge on the Wisconsin Court of Appeals. And I think we're going to have a great discussion here this afternoon, and a very timely and relevant discussion. When I took the bench, I actually had to swear an oath to enforce not just a constitution generally, but two constitutions. I swore an oath to support the Constitution of the United States, and I also swore an oath to support the Constitution of the state of Wisconsin. And in fact, as we all know, we're governed by two charters of liberty. Now, we often think about that. We obviously have a federal government and a state government, but that becomes, I think, particularly interesting when you think about the fact that both of these documents purport to protect some of our individual rights. When corporation began roughly 70 years ago, of federal rights, federal constitutional rights, the Bill of Rights against the states, it created some interesting theoretical and practical questions. So for example, we've got a state constitutional provision that protects the right against unreasonable searches and seizures. We also have a federal constitutional provision that is nearly identical, with the exception of maybe some punctuation. What you've seen is how courts wrestle with how to balance these things out. We've also seen doctrines that have developed in state law be incorporated, no pun intended, into some of our state constitutional law. So, for example, we've got a federal equal protection clause, but Wisconsin doesn't actually have an equal protection clause per se. It has what you might call a Declaration of Rights from the Declaration of Independence clause. It says all people are born equal and free and endowed by their creator to certain rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and governments are instituted to secure those rights. Straight out of the Declaration of Independence, modestly paraphrased in our Constitution. And our courts have often interpreted that as something relatively coterminous with the Equal Protection Clause, which says something entirely different. So this raises all sorts of interesting and practical questions, and I'm excited to see how that conversation is going to develop today. And we have three really distinguished panelists to help us with that. So first, we have Professor Joseph Ranney. Professor Ranney is a partner at DeWitt Ross & Stevens here in town. He also happens to be an adjunct professor of legal history at Marquette Law School, and I think it is fair to say that he is the preeminent Wisconsin legal historian today. He's written a number of books about Wisconsin law, including most recently, just published last year, Wisconsin and the Shaping of American Law. So if you haven't checked out any of his works, you definitely should do that. And he is going to help introduce this issue to us, as well as provide some perspective about how Wisconsin courts have dealt with these questions throughout history. Up next, we have the Honorable Jeff Sutton, who is on the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. He was appointed by President Bush in 2003. Prior to that, he was the Solicitor General of Ohio, and before that, a partner at Jones Day in Columbus. He's an incredibly accomplished lawyer, as well as judge, and well-respected. He's argued 12 cases in the United States Supreme Court. He clerked there for Justice Powell, as well as Justice Scalia, as well as on the Second Circuit. He's a graduate of the Ohio State University School of Law, College of Law, where he also serves as an adjunct professor. He also is someone who's thought deeply about these very questions. And just this last year, or actually just in a few weeks here, has a book coming out called 51 Imperfect Solutions, States and the Making of American Constitutional Law. So we'll be excited to hear his thoughts on that today. And then finally, closest to me, we have Chief Justice Stephen Markman of the Michigan Supreme Court. And he has been on the court in Michigan since 1999. Prior to that, served on the Court of Appeals there. He also served in private practice. He was a U.S. attorney as well, served as an assistant attorney general in Washington, D.C. And he also, during the Reagan administration, was the head of the Department of Justice's Office of Legal Policy, which is the principal policy development office in the department, as well as helped coordinate the federal judicial appointment process. So I could go through a lengthy list of every one of their writings, but we've got three incredibly well-accomplished scholars and thinkers, all of whom I think are going to be very helpful today. The way this is going to work is Professor Ranney is going to give us the first introduction to the issue, and then following that, Judge Sutton, and then Chief Justice Markman. And then following that, there's going to be a bit of an open discussion between all of them responding, and then at some point, we'll open it up for questions as well. So with that, I'll introduce Professor Ranney.
Thank you, Judge Hagedorn, and thank you all for having me here today. The new federalism as an intellectual concept is of relatively modern vintage, but the interplay or the potential interplay between state and federal constitutions goes back a long way. It, in fact, could be said to predate the beginnings of the American Republic. In the Revolutionary era, the first American written constitutions that were effective documents for an entire state were documents that were written by the brand new states during the Revolutionary War. Many of these states incorporated basic civil liberties provision into written documents for the first time. Some of the most notable state constitutions of the era were particularly the New York Constitution of 1777, the Pennsylvania Constitution of 1776, which was considered in its day probably the most radical constitution ever written, and also the Massachusetts Constitution of 1780. The Massachusetts Bill of Rights is still in effect today, more than 200 years later. If you look, however, at the state Supreme Courts of the new states implementing their constitutions after the Revolution, it's not entirely clear that they were dedicated, as many judges are today, to exploring the meaning of the state constitutions as distinct from federal constitutions. I have to confess that during the course of my idle hours as a lawyer, I have spent more time than I probably should looking at old obscure state Supreme Court decisions from all around the country. And I will tell you, although I have made no systematic analysis, I don't really see any focus in the state Supreme Courts or in federal courts, for that matter, on the issue which later became the new federalism. That is the question of whether analogous provisions in the United States Constitution and in state constitutions should be interpreted differently. Very briefly, what kinds of constitutional issues did state Supreme Court judges focus on in the 19th century? Well, there really wasn't nearly as much focus on constitutional issues then as there has been in the 20th century. To the extent that state judges did focus on constitutional issues, it usually involved things like the impairment of contract clauses. One example would be there was a big controversy in the early 19th century as to whether state governments were constitutionally authorized to provide grants and other subsidies to railroads. The argument was the railroads were essentially private companies, and therefore many disgruntled taxpayers who got taxed to fund railroads argued this was a deprivation of our property, that is, our tax dollars, without due process of law. That argument usually, with a few exceptions, including Wisconsin, got shot down in most courts. They said state subsidies were okay, but it is striking to me they talked about due process in general terms. Most state courts really didn't draw a close distinction between state constitutional due process clauses and the federal due process clauses. That trend continued into the late 19th century. The big topic in the late 19th century for state Supreme Courts, and one which really brought them for the first time a major role on the national constitutional scene, was substantive due process. You folks, I'm sure, have learned about this in law school con law courses, and I dare say prior Federalist Society meetings have discussed that issue. But basically, substantive due process is a mélange, a mixture of separate strands of doctrine. Basically, substantive due process was used by state Supreme Courts as well as federal courts to examine the validity of corporate reform laws prior to the Progressive Era and during the Progressive Era. Courts used the due process clause, both state and federal, to examine the validity of those laws, but they also looked at reform laws in terms of the contracts clause, whether regulation of companies impaired the company's contract rights, for example, to negotiate freely about employment bargains with their employees. They also, courts also looked at the equal protection doctrine. Were reform laws which singled out specific economic sectors violative of equal protection? Were they discriminatory? And courts also looked at the delegation doctrine. That's a doctrine that essentially says only the legislature, not agencies, may make policy. That's not specifically written into the federal or state constitutions, but many state courts kind of implied it out of both types of constitutions. What is striking, again, is if you go through state Supreme Court decisions applying substantive due process in the late 1800s, early 1900s, to reform laws, once again, even though this was a very hot topic at the time, extremely controversial, both in the political arena and in the judicial arena, there is very little distinction that I can find that state courts make between the federal constitutional provisions and state constitutional provisions. They talk, for example, about things like impairment of contract. They talk about violation of due process, but they don't really say whether they are looking at federal or state constitutional clauses. They just talk about these doctrines as though they're kind of abstract doctrines just out there in the legal ether. That being said, it's fair to say that state Supreme Court judges saw those doctrines, whether viewing them as embedded in constitutions or out there in the legal ether, in very different ways. We've heard, for example, in con law about the leading case in what many people consider the chamber of judicial horrors, Lochner versus New York, in which the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a New York progressive era law limiting baker's hours. What most people don't realize is that the New York Court of Appeals, the state's highest court, saw Lochner very differently. That was a deeply divided court on, I believe, a 4-3 vote actually upheld the law. So there you have an example of how judges at the federal level and the state level viewed constitutional rights very differently. So it's perhaps all the more surprising that they didn't really talk about state versus federal clauses, and it is somewhat surprising that the New York Court of Appeals, which obviously wanted to uphold the Baker's Hours Law, didn't look to the New York state constitution. Interesting that this apparently was just not on the judicial radar screen at the time. So when did the new federalism come along? Well, new federalism as a concept remained dormant throughout much of the early 20th century. That was a time, as I believe Judge Sutton and Chief Justice Markman may allude to later, where the interpretation of constitutional rights was taken over primarily by federal courts. That was a time when the Federal Bill of Rights was extended in many cases to the states, particularly many criminal defendants' rights, due process rights, were extended to the states through the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause. State Supreme Courts once again took a back seat, at least in the criminal procedure area and in many of the other areas that came up during the era asking about the Bill of Rights. As most of us know, particularly those of us who are old enough in the room to have been alive during that era, federal incorporation, federal expansion of the Bill of Rights to the states kind of reached its zenith during the tenure of Chief Justice Earl Warren, during the Warren court years, which ran from 1953 to 1969. Chief Justice Warren retired from the court in 1969. That was a time when the post-World War II liberal consensus was starting to come to an end. President Nixon had just taken office, and there was much concern among liberals at the time that Nixon's new appointees would make a systematic effort to erode the expansion of civil liberties, which the Warren Court had undertaken. So there was a two-part reaction to the passing of the Warren Court and a two-part response to the fear that perhaps the Berger Court, its successor, would unroll some of the reforms that the Warren Court had made. The first response came from state Supreme Courts, actually. It began in a California case called People versus Anderson in 1972. In the early 1970s, there was a controversy, serious controversy, at both the federal and the state levels as to whether any sort of death penalty was constitutional, whether any sort of death penalty would be, by definition, violative of the Eighth Amendment prohibiting cruel and unusual punishment, and would be violative of analogous state constitutional clauses. So in the Anderson case in 1972, the California Supreme Court eschewed looking at the federal constitution and held that under California's cruel and unusual punishment clause, the death penalty was per se unconstitutional. That decision became immediately controversial. On the one hand, several other state Supreme Courts went along with the Anderson decision, courts in Massachusetts, Oregon, New Jersey, and New York, but there was a substantial and pretty immediate political blowback. Each of the states that I've just mentioned, the voters ultimately passed constitutional amendments explicitly overturning the decisions that had held the death penalty unconstitutional. That also triggered an ongoing controversy where in states that elect their judges, it is very often a campaign issue whether the judges who are running for election are tough enough on crime. And there have been, in various regions of the country, not just in the North, several state Supreme Court judges who have lost their seats because they were perceived as not tough enough on crime, because they had struck down application of the death penalty in some of the cases they had decided as judges. The second prong of the reaction to fear that the Burger Court would roll back some of the actions of the Warren Court came in 1977. U.S. Supreme Court Justice William Brennan, who was in many ways a close ally of Chief Justice Warren, wrote a seminal article in the Harvard Law Review introducing the new federalism, popularizing it for the first time, so to speak, as an intellectual concept. Justice Brennan argued that states' constitutions had been unfairly neglected for a long time. He basically urged state Supreme Court judges, particularly in states where there was much concern that civil liberties would be rolled back, he urged state judges to consider using their constitutional clauses to preserve or even expand notions of civil liberties. He pointed out correctly that if a particular measure is held unconstitutional under a state constitutional provision, there is very little that any federal court can do to overturn that or otherwise interfere with it, because the federal courts, obviously, as courts of limited jurisdiction, can only say whether something is unconstitutional under the federal constitution. Chief Justice Brennan's article was widely publicized and was discussed in state courts around the country. There were several judges around the country who emerged as champions of Brennan's position. They included Oregon Justice Hans Linde and California Justice Stanley Mosk. Both Mosk and Linde were unqualified supporters of Brennan's proposed doctrine, and they wrote a number of law review articles themselves and tried in some decisions of their respective courts to promote the idea that their state constitutions should be used creatively to expand civil liberties beyond what the U.S. Supreme Court was willing to do. Another prominent figure in the debate over the new federalism was our own Justice, formerly Chief Justice Shirley Abramson. Chief Justice Abramson wrote a number of important law review articles. She, however, I think contrary to popular stereotype, was not as unqualified in her enthusiasm for the new federalism as Linde and Mosk had been. She wrote an article in the mid-1980s basically saying, which is kind of the quote at the beginning of my presentation in the handouts here, that both supporters and opponents of the new federalism should be careful what they ask for, they just might get it. She pointed out that creative state constitutional interpretation is not necessarily limited to the Bill of Rights. It's not limited to criminal procedure. It's not limited to civil liberties. For example, she pointed out that an emerging issue in the 1980s was the eminent domain question, which later came to the forefront in the U.S. Supreme Court's Kelo case. She pointed out that state constitutional eminent domain clauses could be creatively interpreted to allow broader taking and different takings in some areas than the U.S. Supreme Court had dealt with. And she pointed out there were some ways that creative use of the eminent domain clauses could potentially be used to insulate broad powers of taking from strict scrutiny by the U.S. Supreme Court under the federal Constitution's takings clause. So very briefly here, the new federalism movement took off from there, and I think it's fair to say that whichever side of the fence you're on that, I think all agree that it has assumed a prominence in modern judicial thinking, in modern legal debate among scholars, judges, and practitioners that it never had before the early 1970s. A couple of quick examples. I think probably the most prominent example of creative use of state constitutions is in the gay marriage movement. When I studied the issue, it was striking to me that right up until the last couple of years before the U.S. Supreme Court declared that there was a constitutional right to same-sex marriage in the Obergefell case in 2015, that struggle had been going on for the better part of 30 years, and it had gone on almost exclusively in the state courts. The very first court that found a constitutional right of gay marriage was the Hawaii Supreme Court in the late 1980s, early 1990s, and the Hawaii Supreme Court relied on the Hawaii Constitution. Perhaps the two most important cases, the Baker case in Vermont, which Vermont became the first state in 1999 to find a constitutional right of civil unions, was based not on the U.S. Constitution's Equal Protection Clause, but on a Vermont declaration, provision in the Vermont Declaration of Rights called the Common Interest Clause. It's kind of unique to Vermont. It was created during the Revolution in 1777 when Vermont was kind of remote from everybody else in the United States, including legal influences of other states. And the Vermont Supreme Court took this 200 years later and used it as a basis for the first, what paved the way for the America's first civil unions law. The other big decision, the Massachusetts Goodridge decision in 2003, which said not only is there a constitutional right to civil unions, there is a civil, same-sex couples have a constitutional right to legal rights associated with marriage and to call their relationship marriage. The Massachusetts Supreme Court also relied on the state constitutions. Other courts, for example, the California Supreme Court, the Iowa Supreme Court also relied on their state constitutions. It's striking that advocates of same-sex marriage during those years stayed away from talking about the U.S. Constitution. I think from what I have read that the reason for that is there was a great deal of doubt as to whether the U.S. Supreme Court was prepared to read a right of same-sex marriage into the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution. That did not change until 2010 when the Northern District of California, after California voters had overturned the same-sex marriage decision of the California Supreme Court by constitutional amendment, after that, same-sex marriage advocates decided it was time to try their luck in the federal courts. And they went to the Northern District of California, secured after a lengthy trial, which was basically a forum for debating the policy pros and cons and the legal pros and cons of same-sex marriage. Judge Vaughn Walker of the Northern District of California declared that under the U.S. Constitution's Equal Protection Clause, there was a constitutional right to same-sex marriage. That kind of opened the floodgates. Between 2010 and 2014, a flood of cases were filed in federal district courts all over the country. With a few exceptions, one of which Judge Sutton was involved in, most district courts and a few appeals courts agreed, yes, there is a right to same-sex marriage under the U.S. Constitution. And ultimately, the U.S. Supreme Court, by a 5-4 vote agreed. But it is striking to me that is one area where the new federalism was used with a vengeance to try to shape creatively new concepts of constitutional rights. So to just briefly conclude, what has the role of the new federalism been in Wisconsin? Well, we haven't been laggards. I think it's fair to say we haven't been leaders either. The same-sex battle did not come to Wisconsin until after the federal phase had begun. We did not get a court decision on same-sex marriage until 2014. Back in 1977, at the beginning of the new federalism movement, the Wisconsin Supreme Court, in a case called State versus Doe, said that it reserved the right to apply the new federalism. But the fact is that since the Doe pronouncement came down, with a couple of exceptions in 2004 and 2005, the Wisconsin Supreme Court has followed the lockstep approach. That is, the default for the Wisconsin Supreme Court has been to interpret provisions of the Wisconsin Constitution identically to their analogous provisions in the U.S. Constitution. There were a couple of exceptions in 2004 and 2005. In a case called the Knapp case, the court interpreted Wisconsin's Miranda rights a little bit more broadly than the U.S. Supreme Court has. And in a case called DuBose, they interpreted the Wisconsin Constitution to provide more procedural safeguards to defendants in the context of lineups than the U.S. Supreme Court did. Justice Diane Sykes, now Seventh Circuit Judge Diane Sykes, who was on the Wisconsin Supreme Court at that time, accused her colleagues of basically trying to legislate a political agenda through use of the new federalism. I think with the benefit of hindsight, that's not entirely accurate. As I say, the DuBose and the Knapp cases were kind of the exceptions to a general policy that the court has followed of being in lockstep with the U.S. Supreme Court. So just briefly to conclude here, where does this all leave us? I'm sure we'll be talking about this today as the panel goes on, and it's an issue that hasn't been completely resolved, perhaps never will be resolved. But my two cents are that I don't think you are going to see the new federalism systematically used in the future as part of a campaign to liberalize criminal defendants' rights, liberalize civil liberties, or anything else. I think there may be isolated movements, isolated decisions from time to time, but I think Justice Abramson was right. The new federalism is a two-edged sword that can be used in two, maybe many more different political directions. I think it's also fair to say human nature and perhaps judicial nature being what they are, the new federalism essentially hands state courts a tool saying, look, you have in reserve this right to interpret your state constitution to require certain items that the U.S. Constitution does not guarantee. I don't see any judge, except perhaps an unusually self-sacrificing one, willing to give up that potential tool, that potential instrument of power. But what I do think is, as we go forward, the new federalism will continue to be a flashpoint for debate. I think you will see continued use of it, but I think the uses you will see will be mostly isolated, mostly idiosyncratic to particular states. And as is true of the central lesson of legal history, I think things will happen in very unexpected ways. There will ultimately be unanticipated consequences. So with that, I will turn it back over to Judge Hagedorn, and I look forward to the discussion.
Judge Sutton.
Yes, thank you. You know, when I was an advocate, I preferred to stand, but now that I'm a judge, I prefer to sit. So forgive me. Real quickly, I'm going to respond to Professor Rainey. Is it Rainey?
Rainey.
Rainey. Talk about this perspective, but disagree is really the wrong word, but it's more about hope. I very much hope that when it comes to state courts and state constitutions, we're about to have a revolution when it comes to independently interpreting them. So the new federalism, I hope, explodes. So one downside of writing a book is all you want to do is talk about it. That's why my family sent me out here. They're tired. You now have me, and that's all I'm going to talk about, and I'm very into it. So the number 51, showing what my middle child thinks of me, he's 24. When he looked at the galley proof for the book and the cover, he had this awkward expression on his face, and he looked at me and said, but Dad, I think there are 50 states. And he's afraid I'd launch this book and I didn't know how many states there were. You know, it's what's bad about that, he's my son. For 24 years, he's watched me make similar mistakes. So he, you know, was probably right to think I'd messed it up. Well, the 51 actually I got right. It's 50 state constitutions, one U.S. Constitution, 50 plus one gets you to 51. So the point of the book is American constitutional law books really all have the same narrative. It's really pretty easy to figure out. It tends to focus on the U.S. Supreme Court and the federal Constitution. The narrative is usually the same. States as villains, federal government, U.S. Supreme Court as heroes. If you've got that, you'll pass the bar exam when it comes to con law questions. So I didn't set out to contradict that narrative because, well, first of all, there's ample support for it. There's Jim Crow, there's Brown versus Board of Education. You go beyond the South, it's Ohio versus MAP, it's Arizona versus Miranda. But I did think it was appropriate to supplement that story with a story that talks about situations in which state courts, using state constitutions, by the verdict of history, have been the heroes rather than the villains. So there are really four chapters that do that, and I'll talk about one of them, the eugenics movement, that illustrates the point. So, but why did a federal judge, what led me to want to do that? By the way, in 15 years, I've had only one state constitutional law issue. Very sad. One day my ship will come in, and you wait, it'll be quite a decision when I get some of these issues. But I don't get this stuff, so it probably seems very strange that I would want to write about it. My experience was like you. I went to a law school that offered a course on con law, didn't offer any courses on state constitutional law, and the federal course focused on the federal constitution. What really changed things for me was when I became State Solicitor of Ohio in 1995. And suddenly faced several cases involving challenges under the state constitution to various state laws, a school funding case, a vouchers case, tort reform, unreasonable searches and seizures. I tell my students at Ohio State and Harvard that I could teach a semester-long course based exclusively on cases I lost in the Ohio Supreme Court under the Ohio Constitution. So that was a wake-up call. So I found myself going, well, this is very significant. Why wasn't it taught in law school, and why in practice was I not seeing more of this? And why isn't more of this going on? And that's really what formed the sources. I guess the other thing I would say about that experience working for state government is I just never saw anything in the state AG's office, working with the governor's office, the General Assembly, the state courts, that suggested, that was consistent with the traditional con law narrative, with, you know, bigoted state employees only interested in self-interest. I mean, you know, they weren't perfect, they weren't geniuses, but I certainly didn't see anybody any worse than the federal government. I didn't see state court judges any worse than the federal judges. And so that just made me think we really need to correct the story, at least supplement it. I'm not alone, or I wasn't alone before my experience in the mid-90s and not knowing much about state constitutions. There was a poll in the 1980s in which I think under 50% of Americans knew their state even had a constitution. That's very strange given that we Americans so applaud, embrace, cherish judicially enforceable individual rights. The irony of this is all of these individual rights originated in the state constitutions between 1776, some of them before July 4th, 1776, up to and before the fabled summer of 1787. That's where the individual rights come from. I mean, the only patentable innovation in the U.S. Constitution of 1789 is splitting the atom of sovereignty and federalism. That's the innovation. But when it comes to individual rights, specifically guarantees like the Bill of Rights, those are all borrowed from the state constitution. So it just seems appropriate, if you're an originalist, but even if you're not an originalist, to pay attention to what these original guarantees meant, what they were trying to get at. You'd think people would pay a little more attention to that. Now, as Professor Rennie pointed out, for the first 150 years of American history, you really didn't have dual chances to knock out state and local laws. You know, for the first most of American history initially, it's really best to think of the U.S. government in its separate sphere, limited by the Bill of Rights, and the states in their separate spheres, limited by their own state constitutions. But after the 1930s, it's, of course, overlapping power. And after incorporation, you now have dual opportunities to challenge state and local laws under either the U.S. Constitution or the state constitution. And it really is quite puzzling that people would not want to use both opportunities when they go to state court. And that, it seems to me, is one of the funny things I'm trying to get at with this book. Now, why is it that a state court might take a different path than the U.S. Supreme Court has taken in construing identical language or similar language in an individual rights case? Well, first of all, the text of these guarantees, as Judge Hagedorn pointed out, is not always the same. In fact, they vary all. If you think of the religion clauses, they're all over the map. The minority of states have a religion clause like the U.S. Constitution. So they're really much more elaborate, both on the free exercise and, given the Blaine Amendments, the Establishment Clause side. So one reason a state might chart its own path in any of these areas is the text is different, different words, different meaning. And quite often, the history is going to be different. I mean, think of a free exercise dispute being litigated in the Rhode Island, Maryland, or Utah Supreme Courts. Those are going to look a little different than they might look in another state, given the history behind those states and how they were founded by a minority religion. So text, history, all could justify a state court taking a different path from the U.S. Supreme Court. Why else might they chart a different path? There's nothing wrong with a state Supreme Court simply disagreeing with the analysis of the U.S. Supreme Court construing similar or even identical words. Sure, the Supremacy Clause says they've got to honor U.S. Supreme Court decisions when it comes to a U.S. constitutional claim, but the same is not true when it comes to state constitutional claims. So, for example, if you have a living constitutionalist U.S. Supreme Court decision, there's no obligation by a state court where a majority of them are originalists to follow that analysis. In fact, it would be incredibly odd if they followed that analysis. The same is true in the reverse. So you could have disagreement because of a different methodology of interpretation, which of course happens quite often. Or you could have disagreement even though the words are exactly the same. Unreasonable searches and seizures. I mean, in a case in which there's no historical analog to the 18th century, there is no reason why 9 people, 7 people, 5 people are all going to see the word unreasonable the same way. And yet we largely live, as Professor Ryan says, in a world where there is a lot more lockstepping than not. And when I say lockstepping, just following the U.S. Supreme Court wherever it goes in construing this guarantee or that one. You know, it's very strange. I mean, you have some state Supreme Court doctrines where they say, boy, on the Establishment Clause, we do whatever the U.S. Supreme Court does. On the Free Exercise Clause, we do whatever the U.S. Supreme Court does. How do they know what the U.S. Supreme Court's going to do in the future? Who takes a voyage without knowing a destination? I mean, that really makes no sense. So the second reason is just disagreement. Just as U.S. Supreme Court justices can disagree with each other on what unreasonable searches and seizures mean, surely state Supreme Court justices can do the same when it comes to their own analog guarantee. The last reason is probably the best reason why it's not only permissible to disagree, why there should be much more disagreement than there currently is. Most of these guarantees are written in such generalized terms, it's frankly ludicrous to say that there is one and only one way to look at the language. That's the point of the title of the book. Sometimes we're stuck with imperfect answers to interpretive debates. Why in the world would we want a system in which we insist on one imperfect solution rather than 51 imperfect solutions where we might learn a few things along the way? Equal protection jurisprudence, tiers of review. According to Professor Tribe, I think we're now up to 7 tiers of review. All right. At some point, it becomes a joke. And at some point, it seems to me, state courts ought to say, you know, the tiers of review experiment isn't working. We're either going to have 2 tiers of review, or we're going to have 3, or we're not going to do tiers of review at all. We're going to try a different, maybe historically anchored approach to equal protection. Due process, procedural, substantive. Sometimes you have liberals that want substantive due process. Sometimes you have conservatives that want substantive due process. Sometimes people want natural law approaches to these things. The one thing I know for sure is it's very hard to say there's just one and only one approach to this. Why shouldn't we have more innovation by the state courts construing their own guarantees? They have the final say over what they mean, a responsibility to say what they mean, and trying a different path from time to time. This is not only good for the citizens of these states, it's not only good for state courts, healthy for state constitutionalism. turns out it would be very good for federal law. Think about how we normally develop law in this country. The common law is a perfect example. Torts, property, contracts. From the ground up, with the states as the first responders, the innovators, sometimes one school of thought gets a competing school of thought. Sometimes it leads to an emerged Hegelian solution, or maybe it leads to three different schools of thought. Sometimes we nationalize an answer. Sometimes we say it's just as well to have four different approaches to this. But the key thing is it's from the ground up with the states looking at it in the first instance. For some reason, when it comes to constitutional law, it's a top-down approach. Everybody wants to race to the U.S. Supreme Court, not in all situations, but most situations, get a winner-take-all victory, and then leave it to the states. Well, you can always go further if you want. Why not do the same thing we do in other areas of law, where we let the states experiment with these new constitutional rights debates? And I must say, I mean, the marriage story is a really good example of that. It proves it across the board. It proves it's a neutral principle. You don't know how it's going to end up. The marriage story, of course, worked the way it did because you had a case from 1972, Baker, where the U.S. Supreme Court had already announced a ruling against it. So you were forced to go to the states to innovate that right first. It was going to be very hard to go right to the U.S. Supreme Court without some explanation, some ammunition for getting them to change their mind. But still, it's a federalism story where it did go through the states first, and it's a ground-up story where they were the innovators, and it was ultimately only nationalized. You know, you can debate about whether it was right to nationalize it, whether it was right to do it when they did it, but the fact is it was a federalism story in that respect. And you know, it's unsatisfying that it's neutral. I mean, I think that's frankly its biggest problem. There never will be a federalism interest group. I mean, because most citizens, most groups like federalism one day, hate it the next. It turns out if you're the opposite of the president's party, you tend to like federalism a little more than when you're the same party. But as a judge, I like neutral principles, and I think we could probably use a few more of them. But the one thing that I know is true is experimentation is always a good idea. Just as Brandeis was right about laboratories of policy-making experimentation, what he's referring to there primarily is legislative experiments, it's also good to have laboratories of interpretive experimentation, where judges are taking these generalized clauses, looking at them seriously in the first instance, and then allowing, you know, schools of thought to emerge, a prevailing view to emerge, and perhaps a decision to nationalize the issue. So, let me now illustrate this with one of the chapters, which tries to, I hope will illustrate why what I'm saying really matters. So most of you know the eugenics movement and the Buck versus Bell story, the infamous 1927 Holmes decision, rejecting Carrie Buck's claim that the Fourth Amendment prohibited Virginia from involuntarily sterilizing her. 8-1 decision, joined by Chief Justice Taft, Justice Brandeis. Only Justice Butler, a Catholic, dissents, although he doesn't write a dissent, so we don't know exactly why. So that's the story I think you all know, three generations of imbeciles are enough, and so forth. The part of the story I suspect you don't know is what happened before 1927 and what happened after 1927. Before 1927, there were 8 lower court cases, 6 in the state courts, 2 in the lower federal courts. 7 of the 8 decisions come out the right way by the verdict of history. Holmes, by the way, mentions none of them in his opinion. There's a wonderful decision from the New Jersey Supreme Court. The best decisions are the state Supreme Court decisions, relying in some cases on the federal constitution, some cases on state constitutions. They have wonderful analyses that today you go, how could the U.S. Supreme Court have missed this? How could they not have followed this approach? Well, that happens. So, obvious point, the states are heroes there as opposed to the U.S. Supreme Court. But the thing that's most striking, and I think the reason that I care so deeply about this issue, is what happens after 1927. So here's a story where the states are doing the right things. Governors are vetoing bills. Superintendents are not enforcing the laws. State courts are striking down the laws. The great U.S. Supreme Court speaks. The great Oliver Wendell Holmes speaks. It all shuts down. 12 more states enact eugenics laws. No more activity in the state courts. State courts don't have the courage of their convictions to do what they'd done before 1927. So it's a really cautionary tale that, one, don't assume only life-tenured federal judges will protect your rights. And two, look what happens if we don't create a system in where we use state constitutions and state courts to protect individual rights in all settings. They won't be there when we need them. They weren't there in 1927, and God willing, they'll be there the next time we have a crisis of that sort. So I could keep going on, but I'm at 15 minutes, so I'll let Chief Justice Markman talk, who is presumptively correct in everything he says.
Well, I don't have to rely on any presumptions anymore that Judge Sutton is correct in everything that he says. And there are very few differences, in fact, that I have with him. I'm very honored to be here before the Wisconsin chapter and to participate in such a distinguished panel. My attention was caught by the last panel when Professor Owens spoke briefly about the former chairman of the Judiciary Committee, Jim Eastland, who is a very strong supporter of the blue slip procedure. That was the subject of the last conference, of the last panel's discussion. And I recall what I think is a funny little story about Senator Eastland, although I didn't find it so funny at the time. But I was hired by the Senate Judiciary Committee about 40 years ago as its minority counsel, which means you don't work for the side of the chairman of the committee, who was Jim Eastland at the time, a Mississippi Democrat, a very traditional Southern Democrat, you know, Southern drawl. I think he must have been 86, 87, 88 years old at the time. And my very first day on the Senate Judiciary Committee, I was sitting there minding my own business, and he called me up and asked me a question, and he said, "Does it feel hot in here?" And it was in the middle of July, so I could understand that, and I said, "Yes, sir. Can I do something to help? Can I turn the air conditioner up a little bit more, something like that?" And he dispensed with me quickly and said, "Go sit down." And I didn't know what, how to understand that reaction. A few minutes later, he called me up one more time. And he said a little bit more vigorously, "Does it feel hot in here?" "Yes, sir, it does feel hot in here. Can I do something to help?" And again, he dispensed with me and had me sit down. And at that point, one of the Republican senators who'd overheard this conversation said to me, "Steve, he's not asking what the temperature is here. He knows you're from Michigan, and he's asking you whether or not Senator Phil Hart is here." It's funny to think about it in the retrospective of 40 years, but I thought at the time my tenure in the committee might have been limited to one day, and I was very concerned about that. In any event, in an effort to maintain some semblance of a living and breathing constitution in Michigan, despite that constitution having been on a respirator since the various Warren Court revolutions of the 1960s, the Michigan Supreme Court in recent years has undertaken to do the following. First, where for many years we'd refused to answer certified questions from federal courts asking for our understanding of the meaning of Michigan legal and constitutional provisions, today we're far more readily willing to do so. And by so doing, we not only show comity with our colleagues on federal courts, but at the same time, we preserve the integrity of the laws and the Constitution of our state in circumstances in which other courts find it necessary to apply those laws. Second, we've been increasingly prepared to take issue with lower federal court decisions concerning Michigan law, where we've disagreed with these, notably prevailing, for example, in the U.S. Supreme Court in a case called Burkhise versus Smith, a jury underrepresentation dispute with the Sixth Circuit, a case in which Judge Sutton was certainly not on the panel. Third, we have jettisoned many federal state lockstep provisions and at least nominally have maintained distinctive understandings of counterpart provisions of the Michigan and United States constitutions, although admittedly not to any great practical consequence for our decision making. Fourth, we've on many occasions accorded more detailed and thorough explanations for our criminal justice decisions in an effort to anticipate federal habeas corpus review. Fifth, we have often cited as the basis for our decisions state constitutional provisions, even where such provisions were essentially duplicative of already cited federal constitutional provisions, in at least an effort to remind the bench and bar that the former charter, our Michigan Constitution, might someday be restored to more vigorous standing. And finally, we have not hesitated to cite our own case law and jurisprudence where we believe this to be relevant and useful in giving meaning to federal laws under review. However, after having undertaken these and other initiatives out of regard for our still somewhat but shaky sovereign institutions, it would be a considerable overstatement to assert that these have genuinely contributed in any meaningful way to the revitalization of either our state constitution or the principles of judicial federalism. Just as in my personal estimation, ours is an era in which institutions of federalism have generally been moribund, so too in particular have institutions of judicial federalism. Notwithstanding encouraging expressions of interest reflected by conferences such as this one and the overall efforts of the Federalist Society. In the years of my political maturity, I have witnessed little serious interest, much less any consistent passion, on the part of either American political party in reviving the federal elements of our constitutional architecture. And it is simply not possible, I believe, that the state of judicial federalism can be any stronger than the overall state of federalism generally. To be clear, I'm very proud of the work of a conservative Federalist majority on the Michigan Supreme Court for much of the last 15 years, in which that majority has rendered our case law far more consistent with the statutory and constitutional law of a state than it formerly was. But at the same time, we've had very few opportunities over that same period to distinguish our state constitutional law from the commands of the United States Supreme Court in giving meaning to federal constitutional law. And thus, as I look about our judicial landscape, and not just in Michigan, I see everywhere growing and stultifying uniformity of laws and procedures, growing power and hearing in the Supreme Court and in the federal judiciary, a growing line of demarcation between state and federal courts in which the latter decides questions of considerable constitutional moment and the former of increasingly little consequence. And I see a growing realm in which the constitutional decisions of the Supreme Court must regularly be scoured by the judges and justices of all 50 states to ensure that each and every one of the Supreme Court's footnotes and four-part tests are indistinguishably elevated as the supreme law of Wisconsin, Michigan, and 48 other states. In short, and with the greatest respect for my more buoyant colleagues around the country, I just see little evidence, not no evidence, but just little evidence of laboratories of constitutional experimentation anywhere or bursts of energy in reviving in some creative or innovative manner dormant state constitutional protections. Which is not, I emphasize strongly, to exonerate state judicial authorities themselves. They're not merely the victims of this. Increasingly, for example, there has been almost no state judicial resistance where federal departments and agencies of both Republican and Democratic administrations have employed their spending authority to impose a growing array of conditions upon state courts, even where those conditions implicate areas of policy that have historically lain at the heart of state judicial authority, including rules and regulations pertaining to child welfare, child support, and child custody. And we're seeing the same now in terms of an expanding range of federal conditions being imposed upon state courtroom administrative and procedural matters, again with little objection by state authorities. One fairly recent exercise of such authority sought to obligate states which had received certain Justice Department grants to pay for English language translators in all criminal and civil cases without regard to the ability of such individuals to pay and without regard for existing court policies in the 50 states in place for that same purpose. Also, concerning the 14th Amendment, I believe that that's what has arguably most stunted the role of state courts in recent years, that is, expanded understandings of that amendment's two great provisions, the Equal Protection and the Due Process Clauses. Not, I would emphasize, because any of these federal interpretations has been necessarily right or wrong, but because cumulatively these have conferred upon the federal courts broader jurisdiction over even the most parochial matters of state law. In Michigan alone in the past several years, we have seen the federal constitutionalization of state laws pertaining to such matters as electoral recount procedures, criminal appeals, sentencing guidelines, straight ticket voting, electoral integrity laws, sex offender registration policies, the advertising of local adult businesses, juvenile sentencing, state prisoner rights, state employee pensions, welfare entitlements, emergency municipal managers, legislative branch procedures, electoral districting, and of course, laws defining marriage. And most of these have been grounded in the due process and the equal protection clauses. And there may now be a large number of state laws pertaining to marriage and its incidents placed in constitutional controversy, many of which will almost certainly be resolved in federal judicial forums, despite the nearly unchallenged autonomy once possessed by the states and their judicial forums in resolving matters of domestic affairs and relationships. The due process and equal protection clauses have become the trumping provisions of the federal Constitution, enabling parties routinely to invoke federal jurisdiction to challenge state legislative enactments and thereby bypassing traditional exercises of state judicial authority over what I believe are essentially and prototypically state affairs. At an earlier time, perhaps in fairness, at a much earlier time, there was some sense that a federal question, a question that invoked federal jurisdiction, must pertain in some way to a matter whose practical impact would be felt far beyond the four corners of an individual state, a question perhaps of significant commercial impact, a difficult matter of interstate commerce, a complex interpretation of a congressional enactment. To the extent now, however, that federal jurisdiction now routinely attaches to the most cross-cutting of all constitutional provisions, what I'm talking about are such things as the fairness principle of due process, the fundamental rights principle of substantive due process, the second-guessing process of rational basis review, the non-distinction principle of equal protection. There is little of consequence anymore in terms of state law that cannot potentially be readily transformed from matters of state concern into federal questions. Further, let me not be the first to opine, and perhaps not the last to opine, that I find almost nothing to celebrate today or 50 years ago in Justice Brennan's unidimensional New Federalism. In truth, there have not been very many occasions on which I or my conservative colleagues have been enticed by the opportunity to adopt constitutional interpretations that even Justice Brennan may have viewed as exceeding the boundaries of James Madison's intentions. Nor do I believe that his understanding of federalism had much to do with the great principles of representative self-government that lay at the foundation of our constitutional system, or that derived their force from the distinctiveness of the 50 states and their local cultures, in the way that Judge Sutton recently spoke. Justice Brennan's supposed conversation with the state judiciary in this regard simply did not and has never included judges and courts with constitutionally traditionalist perspectives, those of interpretivist or originalist points of view, or indeed the majority of we the people in states such as Michigan, who for well over a generation have placed judges and justices of precisely these values on the highest court of their state. We are not looking for opportunities to further expand the realm of courts by creative decision-making in lockstep with Justice Brennan, but rather to restore traditional and more limited understandings of the judicial power under both our federal and state constitutions, and under both those constitutions, the judicial power is the only power that judges are designed to carry out. I do genuinely look forward to the day, and by the way, speaking of Judge Abramson and her concern that there was a two-edged sword to Justice Brennan's creative federalism ideas, I would respond by saying that there, in fact, is not an awful lot of opportunity for creative decision-making in many of the areas of state constitutional law, apart from those that are largely redundant with those in the federal constitution. For example, with regard to our common law decision-making, this is not a creative area of the law. Rather, it's an area of the law that develops incrementally, marginally, and slowly in a retrospective view of how that common law has developed over the course of half a millennium. It is not a potentially creative area of decision-making of the sort feared by Justice Abramson. And the same is true with regard to the rest of what is part of most state constitutions. Other than the restatements of the Bill of Rights, most of the provisions of state constitutions are really very specific. They deal with things like library boards and tax policies and the architecture of state government, and they are so straightforward and clear, it's kind of like interpreting in the federal constitution that a president has to be 35 years of age. There's just not a lot of interpretation that goes into that. There's not a lot of creative or innovative interpretation that goes into that. But I do genuinely, as I say, look forward to the day, but don't believe it will come soon, when the language and values of state constitutions will more routinely become a genuine decision-making factor for state courts. That day will not come until there has been some fundamental restoration of the 10th Amendment to its proper role within our nation's constitutional jurisprudence, as well as a greater recognition of the loosening standards that have developed regarding the scope of the judicial power. Thus far, I've seen relatively little evidence that this time is approaching or that a constitutional renaissance is near. But at the same time, I do have to honestly say, conferences such as this, the attention of so many good people such as yourself, is inspiring and encouraging, as are the observations of, you know, very thoughtful and outstanding and thoughtfully grounded jurists like Judge Sutton and Judge Hagedorn, with whom I'm honored to sit today. I feel good about this conference, but I do think that we need to get a realistic view of exactly where we stand in terms of restoring and rehabilitating a role for the state judiciary in this country that I believe has diminished considerably over the course of the past generation. Thank you.
Well, thank you all. This is really great, and I'm just going to open up with a question and then allow you to answer it or just disregard it and say whatever you'd like in response. It seems to me that underlying Chief Justice Markman's comments it betrays a little bit of a fissure that's occurring right now within even those who might self-describe as originalists. That is, there are some who are much more open to a more vigorous view of the judicial role in interpreting vaguer constitutional vaguely worded constitutional rights, and those who are a bit more skeptical of that process, Chief Justice Markman maybe being of the latter view. And I'm wondering, in particular, directing this to you, Judge Sutton, how much you, or feel free any to comment, how much that might impact the excitement that one might have with the process of a renewed new federalism and interpreting state constitution.
Right. Well, you have to read the book. It answers every question that's raised. One thing about renewed, strengthened interest in this is it's good for every interpretive methodology. So if you're an originalist on the U.S. Supreme Court, you need this. Read Justice Scalia's opinion in Heller. It proved the point. The key move in the case is what was the originally public understood meaning of this Second Amendment in the late 18th century? Where does he go for that? State court decisions construing their guarantees. So as an originalist, you have to have this. The pragmatists, the Justice Breyers of the world need this. The point of the pragmatists is to see what works. Where does the pragmatist get evidence if you don't have a system in which you're waiting for the state courts to experiment and construe this language first? The living constitutionalist is the same way. I mean, be fair. The living constitutionalist, I don't think, wakes up in the morning, looks in the mirror and sees their vision, their view of the U.S. Constitution. I think they understand if they're going to say the meaning of a constitutional guarantee has changed over time, they better find evidence outside their own preferences, policy preferences, that those norms have shifted. Where are they going to get those but from state courts or state legislatures? So this renewed activity is good. It doesn't matter what your method of interpretation is. So both of my friends, those are just great presentations, both talked about Justice Brennan. And I think, I really do think, and he actually set the cause back in some ways. He was not an ideal messenger because he conveyed the impression that this was a ratchet. And whatever we can do at the U.S. Supreme Court, and interpreting the U.S. Constitution, we're just setting a floor, and you guys just keep growing these things. And of course, he wanted you to grow some rights, but not other rights. So not an ideal messenger. But the message was even worse. The message was, just read my dissents in the U.S. Supreme Court, adopt them under your state constitution as the law of your state, when his dissents had nothing to do with the state constitutions. His dissents were about the U.S. Constitution. How is that dignifying and respecting state con law? That's just not right. A way better way to think about this is to think about the period in your state, Chief Justice Markman's state, my state. We were all territories at one point. And before we became states, we had territorial governments. So yours was, I think, 1838 to 1848. You had territorial governors, you had territorial courts, before you became states. Now, what did that mean? Your territorial justices were federal justices. They were only responsible for construing the federal constitution, federal statutes, and applying it. One of the reasons that territories were so eager to become states was to get their own judges. People in Montana didn't want some clown from Harvard coming out to Montana to tell them how the state courts ought to work. When they became states, they got state constitutions. So when you see a state Supreme Court justice presuming the U.S. Supreme Court is right in construing similar language, they're being a territorial justice. Now, I have to say, before you get carried away with that, I'm going to guess most of you have been territorial lawyers, which is to say not doing the independent investigation to figure out what the history of these state guarantees meant, briefing them, explaining to the state Supreme Court why you should have a different interpretation. And the last thing I would say was we have to defeat the Brennan notion that it's a ratchet. Every time a state court is asked, what is the meaning of free exercise, free speech, due process, they're not working with the floor. They can go up, they can go down. Tom Lee on the Utah Supreme Court has a wonderful ruling where they're debating the federal constitution's exclusionary rule didn't cover this particular debate. The question was whether the Utah Constitution's Fourth Amendment counterpart filled in the gap. Justice Lee does the research and he realizes, wait a second, in 1891 or whenever the Utah Constitution was adopted, it would have been foolish to think they meant to adopt an exclusionary rule. So he wrote a wonderful opinion saying there is no exclusionary rule in this state. So it can go down and it can go up. Don't assume it can only go up. That's the whole problem with this project. Everyone thinks it is a one-way ratchet. Not I guess that's redundant. It's not a ratchet, period. It can go down and it can go up. And, you know, there's lots of good court decisions that do that and help, you know, address that problem.
Can I just ask you on Judge Sutton, I mean, how do you counsel a member sitting on a state Supreme Court who's looking at a precedent from the United States Supreme Court and perhaps inclined, as Judge Lee was, or yourself, to think that this is not a one-way ratchet and that there is some flexibility to go in multiple directions? How does he respond to his colleagues who say you're disregarding the U.S. Supreme Court? You are taking your own path, and that's not the way we do things. We've got a hierarchical system, and just as we expect our Court of Appeals and our trial court to abide by our decisions, they expect us to abide by their decisions faithfully and responsibly.
Yeah, so I think in a dual claim case where you have a Fourth Amendment case under the U.S. Constitution and a Michigan counterpart unreasonable search and seizure claim, yes, the state Supreme Court does have to honor all U.S. Supreme Court precedents in dealing with the Fourth Amendment case. It has no equivalent duty when it comes to construing the state guarantee. In fact, I would find it far more relevant what a sister state Supreme Court thought about unreasonable search and seizures under its state constitution than the U.S. Supreme Court, which has a far bigger jurisdiction. So there is no obligation to pay attention. The state Supreme Court can say the color blue means green. It is the final say of what the state constitution means. Now, that might be found to be irrational under the federal constitution. You get into trouble that way. But the fact of the matter is they have the final say in what the state constitution means.
But can I just ask you one follow-up question? You can either interpret this, the federal or the state provision more broadly, perhaps more aggressively or less broadly and less aggressively. If you do so more broadly and more aggressively, more often than not, you're doing something that's not entirely comfortable for a jurist of, you know, perspective that his powers are limited and deferential. On the other hand, if you go less broadly or less aggressively, you know, it doesn't make any difference to the outcome of the case,
yeah,
basically.
Yeah, right. So this is the problem with my, not my problem, but a very good criticism of it by a state court judge. State courts handle 95% of the cases in this country. It's an awful lot to ask of them to suddenly be doing independent analyses of every single case and claim under their own constitution. It's a lot easier to follow a U.S. Supreme Court precedent. But my answer is still, once the state court does what Justice Lee did in that exclusionary rule case, you've announced the rule. You've just proved that the U.S. Constitution goes beyond anything the state constitution does. The state constitution with respect to that guarantee effectively became irrelevant. But that's healthy in two respects. One, litigants know not to raise that claim. And two, what have you just signaled? The U.S. Supreme Court might be wrong. U.S. Supreme Court sometimes needs to correct its own decisions. They're not going to get corrected because the lower federal court judges are disagreeing. We're not allowed to do that. The state courts are allowed to look at exactly the same language and say, deploying an originalist methodology, that does not work. Think of Justice Lee's opinion on the exclusionary rule. It's a perfect example. Exclusionary rule is very much debated right now. If you had 25 state Supreme Courts doing their own ground-up analysis of whether this exclusionary rule is appropriate under their state constitution, that would have meaning at the U.S. Supreme Court, just as it had meaning at the U.S. Supreme Court in Heller, what the state courts, 41 of 43 state courts, said their right to bear arms was an individual right. Justice Scalia relied on that, as he should have. How could it be that 41 of these states, it's individual, and suddenly we're going to say the federal constitution's not individual when they were enacted before the Second Amendment in 1791? So it's time-consuming. It requires lawyers willing to do the work. But it's valuable to the individuals of that state. It's valuable to the U.S. Supreme Court. And frankly, it's the right thing to do unless you want to be a territorial justice, which is a carpetbagger. Territorial justice is carpetbagger. You're not honoring your history and your state. No one wants to be a carpetbagger. That's bad.
Can I say, Can I say that your conversation here is greatly illuminating and inspiring to me, but in part what it... But
maybe wrong.
No, well, I don't know that it's wrong. It may miss one point that relevant, which is that the fact that Heller, and I thought both decisions in Heller were at least focused on an effort to look to the original.
Yeah, they're all originalists, you're right.
So I thought they were both, you know, interesting decisions. But, I mean, the only reason that Justice Scalia could go back and look at so many outstanding, so many state judicial decisions having to do with the right to keep and bear firearms was that the Second Amendment was the last, has been virtually the last of the provisions of the Bill of Rights to be incorporated. So the whole point that I draw from it is that the stultifying impact has been the doctrine of incorporation, particularly incorporation with all the baggage where you can't differ on any of the details or anything, because Scalia was able to go back only because the Second Amendment hadn't yet been incorporated, much less not with all the baggage.
Professor
Rand,
I'd like
to throw a twist in, if I may. I think we've generally been talking in terms of experimentation. Is it a good thing? Experimentation, is it a bad thing? New federalism bad, new federalism good. Question. Many of the critics of the new federalism, from what I've read, have said one of the problems is if state courts are too creative about interpreting their state constitutions, you run a risk of inconsistency, lack of uniformity in guidelines for interpreting constitutional rights in a nation which, for better or for worse, is increasingly nationalized in many areas. So I'd like to ask both judges, do you see possibly some way of distinguishing areas where active application of experimentation might be good versus areas where maybe uniformity is more desirable and new federalism-type experimentation should perhaps be discouraged?
Depends on how much you prize uniformity. I mean, I don't prize it so much that I want a uniform bad rule. And to me, the whole point here is this is why Brandeis was right. And Brandeis was a liberal progressive, but on this he was right. And he may have had different goals than someone later in time might have, but this is a very big country. 51 jurisdictions, 320 million people, huge ranges in cultural, faith, just how we see things. And for me, the first instinct is not to nationalize. The first instinct is to assume state governments, as I experienced when I worked for them in the 90s, are going to be reasonable. They're going to listen to their citizens. And they're when new issues present themselves, new circumstances like privacy today with technology, they're not going to just sit down. They're going to see what's going on, and that's really valuable. So my first point is they're on the ground, they're the ones most likely to be the first responders, and best of all, when they make mistakes, there are far fewer victims. What really bothers me is, and it's very much an interest group driven problem, it's malpractice as an interest group not to want one-stop shopping either at the court or Congress. And at the court, it's best of all, because if you win a constitutional ruling, you've not only nationalized the rule, you have sidelined your opponent. It doesn't get any better than that. Who could not want that? And that's exactly why they're doing what they're doing. And this path is not going to end well, because that's an awful lot of power this court is exercising. Very important to have five justices that are going to do the right thing from your perspective. And, you know, it's going to get very difficult to pick these justices. So I say relieve a little of that pressure. We seem to like judicially enforceable rights. I'm not saying that's going to change anytime soon. That's American at this point. We're just different. We're exceptional in that respect. But I'd like to see a little more of it at the state level so we can account for our differences and maybe be a little more patient from time to time before we nationalize, which is a very strong instinct, but it's not always a great instinct if you're nationalizing not only an imperfect rule, but maybe even a bad one.
I agree completely with Judge Sutton. I mean, if you like uniformity, we're awash in uniformity. We've got more than any share of uniformity that could have been contemplated by our framers. We have Mississippi being treated identically to Utah, being treated identically to Massachusetts, being treated identically to Wisconsin and Michigan, despite vastly different cultures, vastly different demographics, vastly different conditions, all of which would justify a little bit more area being ventilated for policy diversity. And I agree with Judge Sutton. It promotes the values of experimentation. And I would say, incidentally, that it's not just a liberal instinct to promote uniformity, but I'd say one of the institutions that's contributed most to that lack of diversity and that decision-making being centralized in Washington today is the business community, which obviously doesn't want to live by 30 or 40 or 50 different rules and procedures. They're happy to have, you know, one-stop shopping in Washington where they can focus and concentrate all their lobbying efforts, and they can thereby produce a single rule or regulation by which they have to live. And I understand that instinct. But I also understand the instinct that there is something strong and healthy and refreshing in the American experience, that we give some kind of balance to those things that need to be federalized, that the Constitution is spoken of in that way. These are the functions that have generally been given to the national government, and there's a realm in which the states ought to be allowed to experiment and engage in their own decision-making. And I think the 10th Amendment, it distills this perfectly. It doesn't answer with great precision which falls in the one category and which falls in the other category, but it gives some pretty good clues in that regard. And I think if people could just look at the 10th Amendment, mull it over, reflect upon it, ponder it, it would be the starting point in beginning to think creatively and innovatively about how we go about apportioning governmental power in the future, both of a legislative, executive, and for purposes of this panel, of a judicial character.
We have about 8 minutes left, and I do want to open it up for time for audience questions. Judge Sutton, did you have something you wanted to respond to? And if not, people can come to the microphone if you have questions.
I love Professor Rainey's question, but while someone's walking to the mic, if they want to ask us a question, another super practical way to think about your problem or question is think about issues where we have states or segments of the country where it's an 80-20 issue. Okay, 80% of Montanans want something against 20%. And New Jerseyans are exactly the opposite, okay? So one of the great things about state constitutionalism is that should take care of that problem. If 80% of Montanans want something, either their state constitution, state courts, or state legislature is gonna take care of it. And vice versa in New Jersey. And we should be very comfortable with that. And I think largely that does work, and we see it in American government. The main fights we're having are 51-49, 55-45 fights, where we insist on getting that majority nationalized. And yet you just have to wonder if that's always the best thing to do, whether we shouldn't be a little more patient to see if it can get to be a 60-40 approach where there's fewer losers. I don't know. I think Americans, you know, we like winners, not, you know, so we don't mind. the more the merrier. But that's a way to think very practically about it.
Luke, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just curious in what substantive areas you see the most opportunities for the sort of meaningful, original constitutional.
Okay, so one that just really surprises me is we all know there's a great debate going on about separation of powers and the administrative state, all right? You're really not a lawyer if not paying attention to that debate at the national level. I suspect there's a lot of state courts out there that are states where most people are a little skeptical of the growth of the administrative state at the national level, and yet they are adopting the same delegation principles, the same Chevron principles, the same auer deference principles. Separation of powers is up to each state on its own. So that's a real head-scratcher to me. And that's an issue where elections actually facilitate the development of this separate set of doctrines. So that one is unusual to me. You know, this is a great example of the neutrality of the principle. It can go both ways. I mean, you got conservatives and liberals on substantive due process now. I mean, there's a lot of conservatives like, you can't beat them, let's join them. You've got a Texas Supreme Court decision, Patel, which is a really thoughtful decision. You've got this concurrence by now Judge Ouellette. Whatever you think of that decision, first of all, it's a very thoughtful decision. But the one thing I have complete conviction about is that kind of original thinking, original not an originalist, but originalist like creative thinking, should be done one state at a time. I mean, I don't think the right thing to do is to get five justices on the U.S. Supreme Court and quickly do, boom, we've got a majority, let's nationalize that right away. What should happen is you have a thoughtful opinion like that, you get another thoughtful opinion, you get a counter to it, live and learn a little bit, and then and only then do you decide whether to nationalize it. There's so many. I mean, liberal, conservative, I could come up with so many. I mean, all the ones I lost. Still scars on my back.
Judge Sutton, no disrespect, but you're not the only author on the panel. Professor, two-part question. I have a vague recollection of reading something before the age of the internet that the elective justice system in Wisconsin was not only a result of the wave of populism in the 1840s, but also a direct response to federal Supreme Court decisions invalidating state laws providing protection for those who opposed the Fugitive Slave Act. I'm wondering, in all of your research, have you ever run across any authority like that? Because I haven't been able to find it since. And number two, in regard to the elective justice system in Wisconsin, has that elected as opposed to appointed system ever had any effect in any of your research that you found in how the state constitution has been interpreted?
Oh boy, two big questions. To answer your first question, I think the movement for an elective judiciary and Wisconsin's tussle with the Supreme Court were about 20 years apart. I don't have any evidence they're really interlinked. Just very briefly, because these are big topics, Wisconsin was one of the first states in the country to become a state that elected all of its judges. This was part of the Jacksonian movement to give the common people more political power in the 1820s, 30s, 40s than they had before. An interesting example of federalism, Mississippi, of all states, not what at least us Northerners would expect under the stereotype, was the leader, the first state to have all elective judges. It became kind of a trend in the North after that. New York and Wisconsin, I think, were the next states to adopt an all-elective judicial system. It took hold in about half the states. Today, I think about half of all states have elective judicial systems. The other half appoint their judges, either the governor or the legislature. I think as to the second part of the question, what you're referring to is something in the 1850s with the Booth cases, an interesting example of we kind of went beyond the new federalism and took it upon ourselves to try to interpret the U.S. Constitution. Before the Civil War, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the Federal Fugitive Slave Act, which had been amended in 1850 to require state law enforcement officials to help federal officials capture fugitive slaves, very unpopular in the North, regarded as an infringement of state rights. Several judges in the North, including Lemuel Shaw of Massachusetts, said basically, we don't like the law, we personally think it's unconstitutional, but we have to defer to the U.S. Supreme Court because they have spoken in a case called Prigg versus Pennsylvania. The Wisconsin Supreme Court was the only exception to that. In 1854, we basically said, no, the law is unconstitutional, it violates the right to trial by jury, and we don't care what Roger Taney on the U.S. Supreme Court says, we're not going to enforce the law, it's unconstitutional, and they're wrong. They should add, Judge Sutton, Ohio came very close to doing the same thing. In 1858, they upheld the fugitive slave law by a 3-2 vote over two very blistering dissents by the minority.
Isn't there an Iowa case, too? I think there's an Iowa case, too, that's good. I mean, they came out the right way by history. Am I wrong about that?
Iowa, I don't think, dealt with that issue. Maine also decided the issue, but they did that after the Civil War started, by which time it was kind of a moot point.
Well, would each of you maybe take 20 seconds and just give
there was another question.
Well, we're about out of time, so actually I'm just going to, would each of you maybe take 20 seconds and just give any final thoughts or in a few sentences, if you'd like?
My final thought is this. I think that Judge Sutton is correct. This debate over proper methods of affecting and facilitating judicial federalism is no longer just a debate between judges of the left and judges of the right, just judges of these values and judges of those values. It's also a growing matter of debate among conservatives, in particular between more traditionalist conservatives and libertarians. I've spoken with one of my friends and colleagues on a court who takes great pride in his decision in having created a right in his state on the part of hair weavers to engage in hair weaving without having to abide by the licensing standards of that state. Now, were I in the legislature, I would be totally on the side of my friend and colleague on the issue of hair weaving. But I am also greatly concerned with the declining or the diminishing realm within which we, the people, get to make our decisions, and the growing realm, an extraordinarily growing realm, in which courts get to make all the major decisions of our society. And I see that as being the dispositive issue here. I don't believe that people who are committed to traditional constitutional values and virtues prevail where they have courts exceeding their proper powers, accomplishing good things, but nonetheless, in the process, diminishing the role of we the people to exercise their constitutional right to make foolish and stupid policies, which I think is their right, and we should be very loath to infringe upon that right.
Yeah, so thank you for inviting me. This is really a fun panel about something I really care quite a bit about. The stakes are very high when it comes to methods of interpretation, debating methods of interpretation. The federal courts are not afraid to be debating pretty vigorously these methods of interpretation. The state courts are not afraid to debate these things very seriously when it comes to their state constitutional issues. Where we're not having quite as much debate as I would like to see is when the state courts have cases involving similar or identical guarantees. The stakes are so high, we ought to have all hands on deck, including hands on deck, willing to say, we think the U.S. Supreme Court has construed this language in the wrong way. We'll honor it for the federal claim, but we're not going to honor it when we construe our own state constitution. There's nothing wrong with that, and it's actually quite healthy in a system of federalism.
I would just say the uniformity question that I threw out has bothered me for a while. I feel privileged to be able to get the input of two very distinguished jurists on that issue. It still does bother me somewhat. Are there areas where in an increasingly globalized and nationalized society where there are many good economic arguments to be made that there needs to be at least some uniformity? Should that be the case in the courts? Should the lockstep doctrine get more respect than it gets? That being said, I think at the end of the day, I do agree largely with Chief Justice Markman and Judge Sutton that experimentation is a good thing. For better or for worse, the thing that distinguishes the United States in the eyes of most of its citizens, and I think the eyes of the world, is we are a federalist system. We do diversity. Sometimes it's messy. Most of the time it's messy. But it's who we are, and I think that is going to continue. So I look forward to hearing the debate as it plays out in forums and case court decisions to come.
Let's thank all our panelists.